We'll move to the second case of the morning, appeal number 043421, John Doe versus Brady Smith. Ms. Bullock?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ellen Bullock, and I represent appellants. This case is about interrelated themes of power and the credibility of witnesses.
Before you get going here, can you tell me why this plaintiff at age 24 is still a John Doe?
Is still what?
Proceeding as a John Doe.
The plaintiffs moved the court at the beginning of the case. He was an adult, but moved the court at the beginning of the case for leave to proceed under fictitious names.
Why should that be?
I think because it involved childhood sexual abuse.
I know what it involves, but now he's 24 years old. We've seen literally hundreds of these kinds of cases involving this sort of thing where people, once they're over 18, are identified.
I think it probably could have been. We asked the court for leave to proceed under fictitious names. The court granted it. Nobody ever complained after that.
Yeah. Okay.
At a basic, simple level, John Doe lost his trial because his opponents were a powerful and credible school district and its powerful and credible dean, and John Doe was a powerless and disadvantaged and discredited youth. The evidentiary rulings of the trial court subtly and not so subtly puffed the credibility of the already powerful defendants and sapped the credibility of the already powerless plaintiff.
All right, let's talk about some of these specific rulings. In terms of letting in John Doe's three felony convictions, doesn't that help to rebut the claim for lost wages?
John Doe's felony convictions, first of all, they were let in under probative versus prejudiced, as was Smith's conviction. And plaintiff makes a basic assertion that the probative versus prejudiced balancing should have been done consistently for both parties.
I understand that. But my question is whether or not it tended to rebut the claim for lost wages. You were asking for lost wages. He's got three felonies. Hard for a person with three felonies to get a job. That's the rationale, I understand. Now, I have some problem with why the jury needed to know the nature of the felonies, because it seems to me the limitation had to do with rebutting the claim for lost wages. But my question to you is, doesn't the admission of those three felony convictions tend to rebut the claim for lost wages?
First of all, a plaintiff never made a specific claim for lost wages in their complaint. There was a general claim for damages, obviously.
And in terms of jury instructions, was there a claim for lost wages?
No, it was a general claim for compensatory damages. And there's kind of an end run. Every time a civil plaintiff asks for damages, you can't take an end run around the strict character evidence rules and the strict limitations on character evidence.
So let me just make sure. So in terms of the claim for damages, there was no mention in the instruction about compensation for lost wages. That was not in the instruction.
It was general compensatory damages.
Okay. All right.
Yes. And the the three drug convictions that came in very specifically, read to the jury at the beginning of the trial, and read not only the nature of the felony, as you mentioned, but the term of incarceration.
And was there a request that a limiting instruction be given to the jury at the time that stipulation was made up front and when the expert witness was cross-examined?
Not at the time that it was made up front. It was in when the motions in limine were hashed out, there was a request for limiting instruction.
And the court denied that request to give a limiting instruction as to the use?
Yes, the court brought in the three convictions under its terms, which were, as I stated, the...
Right. And what I'm saying is, at the limiting instruction, there was no limiting instruction. I mean, when the court ruled that they could come in and the purpose for which they could come in, and you got the ruling or the plaintiffs got the ruling, was there any request that a limiting instruction be given before those or after those convictions were presented to the jury?
No, Your Honor. And it all comes down to your question all comes down to the probative prejudice balancing test. And again, we have two different convictions at issue. We have John Doe's felony drug convictions, and we have Smith's 2001 conviction for indecent solicitation of a child.
Well, one of the
The problem with the 01 conviction is this is the school district should not be, at least their argument, it should not be straddled with having to overcome that for this claim that they were aware of what was going on in 96.
Yes.
That 01 conviction would be unduly prejudicial in deciding that issue.
There again, if they had wanted to ask for a limiting instruction, if it had come in, they could have asked for a limiting instruction, as the judge has mentioned. But what we have for the school district's liability and Smith's liability, because that is the key issue, when the jury came back, finding that Smith did not convict the state court claims of sexual assault and battery.
Did not what?
Did not commit the state court.
Okay.
Did not commit the state court crimes of assault and battery, or civil assault and battery, sexual assault. And then, of course, they also found the school district didn't know of the assault and battery and was not deliberately indifferent to the sexual assault. There is no way, in some sense, the jury never reached the district's liability because it did not reach Smith's liability, or did not give Smith liability. And until there's a trial that allows in all of the evidence relevant and clearly relevant under congressional public order, unless there's a trial that allows in all of that evidence to decide whether Dean Brady Smith did sexually molest John Doe, then there's no way the jury can reach whether the district was deliberately indifferent to known sexual abuse under Title IX. Another way that the Smith conviction relates...
Well, see, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but on the other hand, there's a counterbalancing argument, and that... It seems to me that's something that ordinarily is committed to the sound discretion of the judge on how the evidence is going to be handled. It's not all black or white. There's a lot of gray in between, and isn't that sort of the situation faced here by the trial judge?
It is sort of the situation, but not quite, and here's why not quite. The trial judge does have discretion, but... that discretion is limited by the federal rules of evidence, and there are two applicable federal rules of evidence. The 413 through 415 rules of evidence talk about other acts of child molestation coming in, including an attempt. And then the 404B rules talk very specifically about evidence coming in as modus operandi evidence, intent, motive.
And let's go back to this intent. What authority or policy supports your position that merely soliciting a child for a sex act is an attempt to commit a sexual offense?
Is an attempt?
Yes.
That's an issue of first impression, I think, and I think it's for this court de novo to decide whether it is an attempt. There is a Missouri case that says repeated solicitations and repeated offers of... different considerations can be an attempt. Attempt focuses on the dangerousness of the criminal, I think, and it also focuses on the disposition. The Rovetsu case, using the Model Penal Code, talks about attempt in terms of dangerousness and disposition. Disposition gets us back to the 404B. Disposition gets us back to what this case firmly dealt with in Romero, which is that child molesters, their intentions and their motives are crucial to both a civil and a criminal case. In Romero, the court stated...
Well, I hate to interrupt, but I want to talk about 415 in the context of this attempt, because one of the positions the defendant asserts is that we should adopt a bright-line rule And it's actually the same rule adopted by the district court, that soliciting a minor for sex may never be an attempt to commit a sexual offense within 415. What's your response to that?
I would disagree. I think soliciting a minor could be an attempt. It has not been held differently in this court. The Eighth Circuit's held differently, but we're not.
Yeah, other circuits have. Two other circuits have held that. Why should we not follow those circuits? I guess that's my question.
Attempt is a substantial, under Illinois criminal law, attempt is a substantial step towards an offense with the requisite intent to commit the offense.
Does state law or federal law control the definition of attempt, and is there any difference?
Well, the federal rules of evidence are telling you that an attempt is admissible in, but I think it would go to state law for this Illinois criminal code on what attempt is. Federal also, I think the 413 definitions include both federal crimes and state crimes. Attempt is the substantial step. When you have a child who cannot consent, no child can consent to sexual activity with an adult or with his dean at school, you have the substantial step in the solicitation, or in the language, the consideration, the offer. It is not defined yet. It is not clear that solicitation can be an attempt, but it's also not clear that it cannot be an attempt. It serves the purpose of what attempt law is aiming to get at, the dangerousness of the act, of the substantial step towards the commission of the offense. Certainly, a person who solicits sex from a minor is taking a step towards a sexual act with the minor. Certainly, that would be any person, any layperson on the street could tell you that's where they're going, that's where they're headed. And they would certainly have the intent, the requisite intent, to commit the act. And there again, we get back to 404B, intent and motive. What was Dean Smith's intent and motive? And this goes to the district as well as to the defendant, Dean Brady Smith. Because at the trial, both defendants, Smith and the district, together had a complete trial strategy of Smith's actions towards these black boys were innocent helping. Smith was trying to help. There was evidence that Smith showed educational favoritism and special treatment to the black boys. That was uncontroverted. That was clear. He held John Doe out of John Doe's class and in Smith's office for at least half of the school year. He took him on one-on-one field trips without parental permission, private field trips. He arranged for him to pass eighth grade, even though he didn't have the academic ability to pass eighth grade or hadn't completed the academic requirements. And there are notes of district administrators saying, hey, the staff at Franklin Middle School, the school where Smith is dean and John Doe is a student, they say Brady Smith goes too far with black kids. Those staff, those are district employees, so everybody knew there was something up with Dean Smith and the black kids.
Although there's no evidence that they knew exactly what was up, and some of the testimony was that they thought he was going too far because he showed favoritism. There was no indication of that they knew about this sexual abuse. But I want to ask you an unrelated question. The other three men who testified at trial, when did they indicate they were abused and what age? Was it the same age range as the plaintiff?
Yes. The three other boys that testified at trial had been Franklin Middle School students when Smith groomed them, and the sexual abuse for those three boys started in eighth grade and or continued through the first.
And can you explain how Tyrone B's testimony is unique and not cumulative?
Absolutely. First of all, federal rules of evidence provide specifically for cumulative evidence. All other acts of child molestation are allowed in. There's an inherent, you get to repeat, you get to have more than one brought in. But in some sense, Tyrone B is not cumulative because of who he is. He was an adult black male with a steady job with the railroad and lived in Indianapolis. He'd grown up and gotten past the troubles that John Doe was mired in. And he came back to the Champaign police voluntarily as an adult and said, hey, this is what happened to me when I was a child and Brady Smith molested me. The similarities are uncanny. Tyrone B. was a lonely African-American teenage boy. Smith isolated him, mirrored his interest in sports.
But isn't this another one of those kind of gray area things, though? This was remote. It was in the 70s. And it was sort of a late discovery, attempt to, maybe shouldn't use the word attempt here in this case, but to call this witness, and the judge is weighing the competing interests there and makes a judgment call.
It wasn't late in the sense there was good cause, and the trial was later delayed, as the brief states. The trial was later delayed, so there was plenty of time to properly present Tyrone B. It wasn't cumulative.
But it was remote, and you already had other witnesses that were going to testify about substantially the same thing.
If the district court had wanted plaintiff to have only a certain number of witnesses, plaintiff certainly would have chosen Tyrone B. over one of the other three boys who testified.
Was that offer made?
No, it was never offered. It was never made.
Yeah, so it's pretty hard to accept that. I'm sorry, but your time is up.
Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Vellert.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I represent a school district, three principals, and an assistant superintendent. Plaintiff is seeking to impose 1983 liability where it's preempted by Title VI and Title IX. The line of cases started in 1996 with Wade, where Title IX preempts 1983 recoveries. It continued through Bolohannes later, stating that it doesn't matter whether you're suing them individually or not, it still preempts 1983 claims.
Well, punitive damages are not recoverable under Title VI and IX, and if we adopt your preemption argument, the plaintiffs would be effectively cut off from recovering punitive damages under 1983, and that's an impediment to the statutory remedy, isn't it?
No, because there is, because we get to Delgado, which carves out an exception for the actual malefactor. They can get punitive damages for Mr. Smith, the person who did the actual, or is alleged to have committed the actual sexual offenses. The other individuals, Ms. Shepard, Ms. Fletcher, Mr. Kane, Mr. Hansen, and the school district, they're people who set policies. They're classic policy defendants. Mm-hmm. This isn't even, you know, there was no indication, no evidence presented at trial, nor in any of the briefs, that these individual defendants in any way behaved inappropriately with any student. So these are classic policy defendants. I think because of that, and applying
classic
policy defendants. Right. I'm sorry. Based upon the C. Clamors doctrine, I think this is clearly preempted.
So is it your position that the statutes cannot coexist when a school district is sued under 1983, or when school district officials are sued, or both?
If I understand your question correctly, I think the statutes can exist, or I'm sorry, the statutes cannot exist simultaneously. In other words, recovery under Title VI and Title IX and under 1983 under any circumstance other than the narrow exception presented in Delgado, where it's the person who's actually committing the offense. In that case, it wouldn't be fair, because then you have the situation that you talked about, Judge Williams, where someone's cut off from recovery. You can't say, well, I'm immune from 1983, and I'm the only person who did it, I'm the actual malefactor, it wasn't a policy, the school district wasn't aware of it, you're out of luck. That's what's not allowed. And I think that's the situation where the statutes, both statutes can exist at the same time, but it's a narrow circumstance. With respect to the admission of the crimes against John Doe, those are brought up in classic cross-examination of plaintiff's expert.
But there was no limiting instruction given, and the court allowed it for a specific reason.
Correct.
And no limiting instruction was given.
No limiting instruction was requested. I think that's an important point. Also, it comes in, it's an abuse of discretion. Clearly, the record in this case shows that those crimes were used for the specific purpose of damages.
And wouldn't it have been enough just to say there were three felony convictions? Why did the jury need to know it was a drug convictions?
I think that's always a classic double-edged sword. On one hand, if you tell them that they're drug convictions, they know what they are, and they assume that the person is involved in the drug world. On the other hand, if you just say three felony convictions, their minds are left to wander. Is it a sexual offense? Is it murder? Who knows? Which is worse? And that's something that's clearly left in the discretion of the trial judge. and there's no abuse of discretion.
If that's the standard, why isn't it left in the discretion of the party who's going to be hurt by that evidence?
Plaintiff could have made a request. Plaintiff could have requested. Once the ruling came in that these three convictions are going to be allowed, there was no request to limit them by type. Just say, Judge, I would just want to have him be straight felonies. Just say he's convicted of felonies, and that's that. There was no request made.
But and you agree that those convictions were very prejudicial.
I think they're prejudicial on the damages part. They were never mentioned by defense counsel as far as Mr. Doe's veracity or character.
Right. So the jury was just supposed to discern that. There were no jury. Not only was there not a limiting instruction given during the testimony, but there was nothing in the final instructions to the jury that
That's
talked
correct.
About the context in which the jury should consider them. I mean, I understand the plaintiffs didn't ask, but the defense didn't ask either.
No, we did not. I think as far as their use, there was some talk in the briefs that there wasn't a specific claim for lost wages. Mr. Doe talked about his employment history or lack thereof. That under the generalized damages that they were seeking, I think it comes in. It also comes in with respect to the cross-examination of plaintiff's expert.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with the three felony convictions coming in because it really does go to the damages and whether or not he has an opportunity to work. I'm just concerned with the nature of the drug convictions. But turning to this attempt business and looking at the facts here, here we had a situation where the child was virtually an arm's length from Smith. He was personally soliciting the child. And isn't that a uniquely dangerous situation that is indicative of a substantial step to commit a sex offense?
No, because I think that if you look at the general principles of criminal jurisprudence, you have an attempt, and whether it be state or whether it be federal, you need to take a substantial step. Otherwise, it makes no sense to have a solicitation offense if it's the same as an attempt. You need to take, in this case, he would have had to make the solicitation, inquire with the minor about having sex, and go one step further. Either pull him in, take out his wallet, give him money, something like that. It's your classic, you know, solicitation.
Well, how do you square that with the solicitation on the internet where the person isn't even present with the child? It's all done by correspondence, and courts have found that that is an attempt to solicit.
I think then it gets to arranging a meeting and taking a step to meet the person that you either haven't met or you wouldn't meet. In
right.
this case, the plaintiff came to Brady Smith's, or I'm sorry, not the plaintiff, the other plaintiff, the person who was the victim of the offense, came to Brady Smith's door. It would be different if Brady Smith wouldn't have picked him up. I think that would be a difference.
But that was at Brady Smith's invitation, wasn't it?
It's reading the wire transcript, it's not clear whose invitation it was. Regardless of whether or not it's an attempt, and I think that the Eighth Circuit is pretty clear in that Bluebird decision that we cited, it's not admissible against the district. 415 on its face talks about cases in the civil case in which a claim for damages or other relief is predicated on a party's alleged commission of conduct. There's no allegation that my clients in any way engaged in sexual conduct, contact, attempt, solicitation, anything with respect to the minor. Because of that, under 415 is not applicable to my defendants, and a case doesn't come in. Plaintiffs admit as much in their reply brief when they say, oh, if it comes in, there should be a limiting instruction saying they shouldn't be considered by anyone else as to any other defendant. But what we have, 415 applies to an individual party, the malefactor, the person who was accepted in Delgado. Additionally, 415, 413, all those rules are subject to a 403 balancing test.
So is it your position that soliciting a minor for sex may never be an attempt to commit a sexual offense within 415?
I think that would depend if there was a substantial charge bargain. For example, there was contact and it was pled down. That's possible. There's no evidence that that occurred in this case.
Let me turn to Tyrone B. because I understand that he walked in. I mean, he called the police, and so the plaintiffs were not available to him the plaintiffs were not aware of his testimony. And so several days before trial, he calls the police. And I understand that the court excluded it, didn't allow that testimony to come in the first instance because you were on the eve of trial. But when the trial was delayed for 11 months, what was the prejudice to the defendants in terms of the late disclosure? There was plenty of time to take his deposition.
Well, except discovery would have had to been reopened.
Right.
And
he was a newly discovered witness.
He was a newly discovered witness.
Right.
We couldn't have issued a subpoena to him when discovery is closed. We'd be filing a court order in that effect. We could have, if he was allowed in, if there was a ruling allowing him in, then we would have filed a motion to do some discovery regarding his opinions and his views. But until he's in the game, so to speak, there's no reason for us to depose him. We can't. It'd be an abuse of process. We can't do it.
Right, but he was, the city was on notice and knew that he was available and that he was out there. I mean, he could have been deposed. I mean, I understand discovery had closed.
Right. If discovery was open and we were free to issue subpoenas under Rule 45, yes.
And you agree that the plaintiff had no knowledge. I mean, I was a trial judge just like the other judges up here, and with newly discovered witnesses, sometimes a witness would be discovered within a day or two of trial. We would just take a recess, and in fact, this case was delayed a couple days, and depositions were taken. It wasn't a big deal. I don't even get that initially, but certainly, there was plenty of time after to take the deposition.
I would agree. There was plenty of time. However, there was a prior questioning was addressed in the briefs. Tyrone B. is an individual who claims that in the 70s, he was sexually assaulted by Brady Smith. This is at a time when Brady Smith is not in a position of authority in a school, so you don't have the same fact pattern that was present for both John Doe, the plaintiff, and the three other individuals. Also, it's 20 years ago. Things like that's when you get to the balancing test. You also have three individuals plus, I believe, two parents, a police officer, and an expert witness all talking about the same thing, talking about the grooming, going over the grooming, going over the pattern and practice of Brady Smith, and saying he doesn't care about these kids. He's looking for one thing. And in that sense, the admission of Tyrone B. would have been cumulative.
But we had a situation with him where he didn't have the kind of background that the plaintiff did, who did have the three felony convictions. So here was somebody who was hardworking, involved citizen. I mean, and there were some distinctions between Tyrone B. and the plaintiff.
Yes, well,
and the other three witnesses who testified.
Right. The other three witnesses weren't saddled with the felony convictions. I think, you know, that if that's bolstering plaintiff's case, that comes in under 415. Even though it's later, and I would argue that, you know, it's a discretion call on the judge, but it's in. That's fine. Because remember, we're talking about the school district's state of mind back in 96 and 97. And the school district's state of mind isn't affected by this testimony of Tyrone B. about what happened back in the 70s, which the school district didn't know until plaintiff filed their motion, or the conviction in 2001, 4 to 5 years after the alleged conduct. So what we have is a situation where it's not relevant to what we knew.
But it's relevant to corroborate the plaintiff's testimony. I mean, the jury has to make different decisions. They have to make a decision whether they believe the plaintiff and whether what he says about what Smith did was true or not. And so it's certainly relevant on the question of whether or not there's corroboration for the fact that Smith engaged in this conduct. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, and I agree that if you subject it to a 403 balancing test, conduct 25 plus years ago is going to be outweighed. The probative value is going to be outweighed by the prejudicial effect. And I would also posit the same would apply to the 2001 conviction, although I don't think it comes in anyway.
Well, in the gamut of this series of rules now, 413 through 415, dealing with sexual abuse, the courts are supposed to look at that testimony liberally. And I think there's a recognition that sometimes this behavior doesn't come to light till many years later.
Oh, I agree, and I think that's why the trial judge, in his discretion, allowed three subsequent victims to testify.
Did you try the case, by the way?
No, I did not.
Maybe it's difficult to answer then, but what was surprising to me is that Smith got a pass.
It was, especially because he was pro se.
Yeah. And what's your best take on why that happened?
Just from looking at the transcripts, I don't think I'm qualified to say that. I don't know. There's, you know, that he was a good employee, and that's what the district saw. He was, you know, he came in with the letters of recommendation saying he was involved in the community, specifically the African American community, especially in light of certain desegregation issues that were going on at the time in the Champaign School District. You know, the district brought him in for a reason.
Well, that was just very surprising to me, that result.
I think it was surprising to everyone. If there's no further questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Bullock, we took a lot of your time with questions, so we'll give you 2 minutes to rebut.
Defendant Smith got a pass because the school district and Defendant Smith cozied up at trial. Defendant Smith was well able to represent himself, but he had a lot of help. They cozied up at trial to present all of his very suspicious actions as innocent helping. The school district, not Smith, presented the witnesses, the white secretaries at the school that said, oh my goodness, thank goodness there are people like Brady Smith. He bends over backwards for those black students. The defendants both got a pass because they presented a united front that all Smith was doing was innocent helping. And that's why the motive and the intent and the modus operandi evidence and the corroborating acts of other acts of child molestation are absolutely imperative to a fair trial against both defendants, all defendants. A couple minor points. 413 through 415 does not limit back the number of years that you can go to get other acts of child molestation. The Donahoe case, an Illinois case patterned using a rule patterned after 415, collects cases that go back 15 years, over 20 years, 13 years, more than 20 years, and all those cases go back because the uncanny similarities can make the evidence corroborative. It also doesn't, 413 through 415, doesn't make a distinction between prior bad acts or subsequent bad acts. So I think that both of those can come in. If the issue of damages, if John Doe's convictions were relevant to the issue of damages, it would be a possibility to bifurcate a trial and first try in a non-prejudicial manner whether there was liability and later try the issue of damages. And
was
whether
that suggested? Were you the trial counsel?
I was the trial counsel.
Was that suggested?
No, it wasn't suggested at the time. That was ruled on in limine. The trial judge made an order in limine prior to trial, so the issue didn't arise again at trial.
It was also not suggested that Tyrone B. be substituted for one of the witnesses of your bank.
No, but it was suggested through the motion of reconsideration that Tyrone B. be presented, and there was time. It was suggested that he be deposed, and he was offered for deposition. No. That was clearly
available. But not that he was going to be
available.
Come in and bat for one of the other witnesses.
Yes, no, that was not suggested. The court made its ruling. But in the motion to reconsider, it was suggested that a deposition be given. And
that motion to reconsider, was that after the case had been postponed?
Yes. There was an 11-month delay, right, first by the court itself, sua sponte, and then by Defendant Smith. In the middle of that 11-month delay, when there was still 5 months till trial, plaintiff moved to reconsider the exclusion of Tyrone B. Plaintiffs rely on their brief for the Section 1983 arguments, but just very, very briefly, substantive due process, the right to bodily integrity, as stated in the Wudke versus Duvall case by this court, is separate from the equal protection.
Okay.
And
your time is up.
Thank you.
All right, we'll move on to the thank you both sides for a fine presentation here. We'll move on to